And welcome back, everyone. We're talking with David Livingstone about his latest book. And I have just so many more questions for David. We'll see if we can squeeze it all in here. It's just like it was last time. I remember we did that first show, and then we had to do a follow-up on right away pretty much because there were so many more questions to get answered. But I wanted to go back again then to a point that you brought up right at the end of the second, and to see, to compare it what we're actually seeing in the world today, David, because it seems that they are, you know, as you've explained, radicalizing Islam. And I wanted to ask what they benefit from doing this. I mean, is the attempt here to unite the rest of the world against Islam, or is it to actually eradicate Islam, their religion and or Muslims? You think if this occult brotherhood and their tradition has a past relationship or maybe an inception point, we shall say, with Islam, that they would be more sentimental perhaps to preserving it? What's going on here, David?
Oh, yeah, they don't have a relationship with Islam. Their relationship has always been to undermine it. I mean, every attempt to create, you know, their factions are subversions of Islam. All the sects, you know, Ismailism, the Asiatic, the Brethren of Sincerity, Sufism. None of those are sincere attempts to represent Islam in any way. They're the opposite. So.
How would you say that, sorry to interrupt you, but how would you say that real Islam is compared to how it's being shown to be today?
Okay, well, you know, this is a substantial portion of my book. And this is why, and this also gets into the issue of secularism and the entire message that the class of civilization is trying to preach. I'm not sure at which end I should start, but basically, the pretext of the class of civilization, we didn't get to synarchism, but this is where this comes in as well. But basically, the whole Illuminati myth of history is that man is progressing to become God, right? And to recognize that he is God. So the history of humanity is the history of man progressing away from religion towards secularism, where he empowers himself as a god. This is how the Illuminati look at history. So they see history as the progression of secularism. The, you know, the major successes were the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and then now the way they're presenting it is the evolution of democracy.
Lots of blood during those conquests.
Exactly. So, you know, this is an idea that starts with Hegel, and Hegel was a Kabbalist. I'm not going to repeat myself. I think I've addressed that previously. And he's the one who created this, you know, what's called his philosophy of history. And Hegel set the stage. And most of these other philosophers, mainly these Illuminati philosophers, all followed after him. One of the most important ones, who was the most important proponent of synarchism, was a Hegelian called Alexander Kolyaev. If we get into that subject, he's a fascinating person to follow. But anyway, he has many important students. Leo Strauss is one of them, but also Francis Fukuyama. So Francis Fukuyama is the one who put forward the thesis of, he developed Kolyaev's thesis of an end of history and put forward the idea of not a clash of civilization. Huntington did that, and Bernard Lewis. But he put it forward the idea of the end of history, which means that all this capitalistic progress has brought us to this point where, you know, occult history has created the West, has created secular states, has created democracy. We have one problem left. We're going to finish, we're going to proceed to the end of history and finish this divine a program. The problem is theocratic Islam, which is presented as completely opposed and contradictory to the message and mission of secularism. So to do this, they have mainly presented examples of Wahhabi fundamentalism. So people's idea of the horrors of Sharia come mainly from the Taliban. Or other examples have happened, like in Nigeria, or of course Saudi Arabia itself, but even in Nigeria, those are Wahhabi influences, and this is a typical example. So most of these instances have been used to create this fear of Sharia, you know, as being this just this awful, tyrannical abuse of religion. And the way that this has been built up is by using specifically the European example to suggest that whenever you have a religion in power, that it inevitably leads to persecution. So it's better not to have any religion, run the show, and we're just going to go with secularism. And the problem with that it's a complete lie, because you can have a state without religion, but you can't have a state without ideology. You need some kind of ideology to guide how you're going to develop the moral principles that your society is going to run on. And so they say that we are in a secular society, but fundamentally we are not. We are a society which is run by a particular set of ideologies wrought from a particular tradition. But to return to my point, the way that they continue to emphasize this is always returning to the Inquisition, the persecutions of the Puritans, and so on and so forth, always reminding of how terrible it's been if ever there's been one person in power. And it's even Bernard Lewis, who is otherwise considered a neoconservative and an enemy of Islam, he himself pointed out that this is a strictly European interpretation and doesn't apply to Islam. Because the West has a particular approach to multiculturalism. The approach here is a secular approach, which is the government has a particular, follows no ideology, supposedly follows no religion, but at the same time has developed a set of moral principles, which it calls human rights. And so it gets into what's called a tolerance paradox, because you want to offer freedom of religion, but then what happens if those religions breach what we consider to be fundamental human rights?
Right.
So it doesn't know what to do. It's a conflict, and it's a paradox, and it's an impossible conflict to resolve, and it's causing obviously all kinds of problems. So the Islamic world has a completely different solution, and this is why the Islamic, even Bernard Lewis again, pointed out, and I went to see him in a synagogue in Montreal, and there he reminded his audience. He said, "Remember the condition that the Jews lived in Islamic empires." And he said, "You have to remember that many times the situation that was offered by the Muslims was superior to the multiculturalism that's offered here in the West. Because the difference is, in the Islamic empire, it didn't require everybody to be a Muslim, right? And the beauty of it is that the numerous religions, so when the Muslims would take over a state, then Islam would immediately become the official religion of the state, but it was never imposed. So this contradicts this whole idea of religion of this, spread by the sword and stuff like that. What they did is they protected the rights of religious communities. And this is where it's exceptional. Communities, separate religious communities, first of all, most people have to pay a tax to the state. Several religious communities were exempted from that tax. They didn't have to, they were free from conscription. They didn't have to join the army. Still, nevertheless, the Muslims were required to be conscripted and still protect the life and rights of the non-Muslim religious communities. And the tolerance went so far that they were allowed to practice traditions even if they contradicted Islam, which means, eating pork and drinking alcohol. Or it went so far, Zoroastrianism has a tradition of allowing incestual marriages. So even if it was things that were abhorrent to the laws of Islam, it was required for the state to tolerate those, whatever it was that were considered the, fundamental beliefs and traditions of those separate religions. So that, in a sense, is the basis of, the Islamic way. And this is why in Islam, there can't be a separation between church and state. And that concept doesn't offer the threat that they claim it does. So then we get back to the point of the kind of nonsense that they're trying to present as being a representation of Islam. So I'm going to try to be brief, but this is kind of important to understand to put it in context. But what happens is that, you know, Islam developed very differently from Christianity or even Judaism. So Christianity started to be formulated at least 50 years after the time of Jesus, and then really only at the Nicene Council, so 300 years later. Whereas Islam started to be developed really immediately at the time during the Prophet's lifetime. And the thing is that Islam very quickly became the religion of a massive empire, which is different from Christianity, which was a religion that was practiced within an empire. It's a completely different scenario. So Islam had to be evolved substantially to develop and sort out all the thousands of rules that were necessary to manage a state of that size. You can imagine all the rules of trade and commerce and legal issues, marriage, adoption, inheritance, on and on and on. So it's a completely different religion from Christianity, which is Christianity, because it abandoned the Jewish law, is basically just a set of moral principles, whereas Islam is an entire legal system that has been devised to serve the functioning of a state. And what happened is that this was a process that took about 300 years to fully develop. And there came a point where the entire academic community, scholarly community of the Islamic world agreed unanimously, okay, we need to stop somewhere. We believe that the essential questions have been addressed. We can't, keep turning around in circles forever. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to move on in the world. So we need to close the debate here. And they did what they did is calling the closing the doors of ijtihad. Ijtihad means free reasoning. So looking at the evidence and trying to reformulate a conclusion about how Allah should be adapted. And it wasn't that ijtihad was no longer allowed. It's just that what happened is the beauty of how this took place is that there was disagreement, but it was all polite debate. And it was debate polite to the point where differences of opinion were accepted. So someone would say, well, I've thoroughly, examined this point and come to this conclusion, but I also acknowledge that you've thoroughly examined your point, and I've considered everything you've said, and I can understand why you've arrived at that point. So that's that. So that's why in the Islamic world, there's four what's called madhabs. There are four schools of jurisprudence. And the Islamic world is divided, into these schools, but they're all part of Sunni Islam. So one person who follows the Hanafi school doesn't consider a Shafi out of Islam. They're all considered mutually compatible and, fully respected and fully accepted. So this was a state of affairs that remained entirely untouched. And the beauty of this is that it was impossible to corrupt Islam because it was firmly established and closed off. So the first time in 1,000 years after after this, the doors of ijtihad had been closed, all of a sudden, you just get this blast of reformers appearing all over across the Islamic world in the 1700s, all calling for the same thing. All calling for a reopening of the doors of ijtihad. And it starts with Abdul Wahhab, who is the founder of the Wahhabi movement in Saudi Arabia. Then there's a few others, and most of them are interconnected. There's Shawliullah in India. There's the Sanusi Brotherhood in Tunisia, which again was a product of British intelligence. And then it just continued on and on and on and on. So if you look at all these British-sponsored, Wahhabi-financed, so-called reform movements in Islam over the last, now 250 years, beginning with Abdul Wahhab, they all have a single message. That message has been to reopen the doors of ijtihad. And what they've done with that is it opens up the opportunity for them to rewrite the laws of Islam. Like the Salafi movement. So the Salafi scholars like Muhammad Abdu in Egypt, it's only by discarding the traditions of Islam that he was able to rewrite Islamic law to make it possible for the British to introduce interest banking in Egypt. And that's just one example. The other examples is things like terrorism. There's absolutely no way. I mean, it's all very, very, very clear, you know, that in Islam, that when you have a legitimate right to defend yourself, no matter what the opponent has done to you, if he turns away, you're not allowed to fight him. Even bombs. This is what's not known, is that bombs themselves are discouraged because they're too indiscriminate, because they have the potential to cause too much indiscriminate harm. So, you know, any kind of military strategy has to be very precise. It has to be specifically targeting people who are holding weapons and attacking. It must absolutely at all costs avoid any kind of civilian or any kind of non-combatant. You're not even allowed to destroy trees, crops. You're not allowed to destroy synagogues, churches, monasteries, things like that. So the only way that they could come up with the absurdities, that the CIA could come up with the ludicrous fatwas to justify the things that they've been doing, like in Afghanistan, the atrocities that they committed in Algeria, is by rejecting ijtihad. So this is what you find with Wahhabis and all these groups, is that that's what the entire basis of their reform of Islam is that they claim, oh, we're going back to the sources, we don't need to go back to the scholars, because the scholars interpret the sources, so we're just going to bypass them and go straight to them, to the sources. And that's the lie that they're using to claim that they're going back to pure Islam. So that's how, through British sponsorship, this complete aberration of Islamic tradition has been created. And you look at all these groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, the Wahhabis, none of them follow the strictures, traditions, scholarship, and methods of traditional Islam, which is all within this madhab system. All of them reject it and all make their own interpretations of Islamic law to come up with whatever nonsense that they've been spewing. That's the essence of the class of civilization. This is what they've created. They've created a mollified form of version of Islam, and two kinds, one mollified version and another jihadist version, all designed to completely neuter the Islamic world, but at the same time, create a horrific version of the specter of the Islamic world to create the pretext for their clash of civilizations, which is ultimately what they want to do, which is to destroy Islam.
I think it's very interesting that I think what you just described is what I've seen in history when it comes to the destruction of other cultures and the way that, you know, many of them have been misrepresented as well. You have people coming in and basically taking over, you know, and then telling, you know, that this is how it's being run. And unfortunately, you do have a lot of people that are, you know, playing into that. I mean, just looking back into the history of Europe, you know, way back before, you know, even some cases where we had the written word, but even up in the north and in Scandinavia and everything else, how things were reformed in a certain way, and then later, of course, misrepresented, and people think, you know, it's all about Viking invasions everywhere. If you think about, you know, so it's interesting because I see the same pattern there. But let me ask you this: where are the other outspoken people that, let's say, understand or know this version that you are talking about? Do you know if there are other people that are outspoken, or is this very, very, is this a very, very kind of, are you very left alone, I guess, in your opinions on this, David?
I hope there's some out there. there's a few. The thing is, see, what I'm seeing is actually just what is accepted Orthodox tradition that had existed pretty much until the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was followed Hanafi tradition and followed the madhab tradition. So, you know, 100 years ago, I would be saying the obvious, but today, you know, I'm a rare voice. And the problem is that they're playing this strange dichotomy now where they're the most vocal and articulate opponents of the Wahhabis, who are calling for a return to traditional Islam, are Sufis. And this is another aspect that I show in my book of how this dual strategy and the Sufis, it all comes back to the same Rosicrucian that I'm talking about. It has to do with synarchism and a traditionalism. It's entirely in the occult tradition. It has to do with George Gurdjieff, Idris Shah, MK Ultra, the Esalen Institute. It's this, particularly this Naqshbandi tradition. And the most, so the most, especially the Naqshbandi in particular, are the ones who are the most vocal, and they command most of the websites online that produce the best information to expose the errors of the Wahhabis. But they use that as an opportunity to then introduce their own deviations.
Well, this is what they do. They set up maybe not even two, you know, it's beyond the Hegelian dialectic at this point. It's multiple controlled oppositional forces to represent the voice of people instead of thinking for themselves and saying, you know, okay, I'm going to, you know, read this for myself. I'm going to study it. I'm going to try to understand it. They immediately think, okay, is there any group out there that I could join or any ideology that I can, you know, start, you know, being a part of basically.
Yeah.
And then, oh, this is good enough. It seems to match. All right. You know, now I'm a whatever. This is how the game is played.
Exactly. They look at them and they say, oh, they're saying everything that I believe. And then, so everything that seems fishy, well, it's probably me who's wrong. That's always the rationalization that people make. And I think that's, you know, that's how cults always work, is that you need to get people to lose confidence in their own ability to discern the truth. You need to tell them that it's something that you need to be educated to understand, or things like that.
Now, what do you make of the multiculturalism that we see in Europe currently? Because it's an interesting scenario how this has both unfolded and how it's been, you know, put together and everything. It seems that, to me anyway, and you mentioned this before, you basically talked about the issues of the Middle East basically being exported to the rest of the world. And this is in one way I think that they've managed actually to do it. You of course not only have Muslims in Europe, a lot of, you know, a high Muslim population, you have a lot of other you know, regions as well. So when you have a mass of people coming in from other parts of the world, you have a kind of a culture where many of the European leaders, like, you know, Merkel and Sarkozy and Cameron, I think it was Cameron. They talked about how multiculturalism has failed and everything else. And they kind of just leave you at that, on that note. I've said this before on the program, but it's almost like they want to encourage conflict in Europe, it seems like, to me. What do you make of it, David?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to explain it fully, but obviously multiculturalism is one of the primary strategies that they're employing. You know, and you look at what they've created, and it's a complete mess.
Yeah, it is.
Really, it's just an awful, ridiculous mess. Like, it doesn't work. It doesn't work in any way. You know, it doesn't address any kind of issues. It really just dehumanizes people in so many ways. So really, in some ways, they're right.
But it's right, but it's meant to be this way, right?
It's meant to be that way, but they're using the pretext that it's failed to blame, you know, largely to suggest even more kind of draconian measures to rope people into the way they think they, you know, people need to be. Because ultimately what they're trying to suggest is that, you know, we brought all these people here and they just refuse to fall into line. They're holding on to their traditions, you know. So I mean, that's the thing, is that the whole pretext of multiculturalism is, it's absurd. It can't possibly work. But, you know, originally I think that it was a strategy against Christianity. That's one of the main purposes, is to completely dilute and deteriorate the influence of Christianity. I think that's largely why they promoted, you know, various other cultures or minorities, to weaken there. That's the thing, is that, you know, their plotting goes against any kind of unifying, you know, ideology or force, and Christianity is one of them as well. Despite what any differences I might have with it, you know, it does offer some very positive, you know, moral values or principles and unifying elements.
It seems what we're talking about is the destruction of any kind of tradition that holds, you know, any water at all, even if it's, you know, as you say, it has its own problems. But the idea is to divide and conquer. You need you need to destroy, you know, native original cultures. You need to break down, you know, national barriers, you know, all the kind of stuff that we have relied on, whether, you know, we consider them to be good or bad or whatever, they've been there and they've held a certain structure in place. But when you knock down these, you know, walls too quickly, chaos will arise from that. And I think that that's been, you know, kind of their game plan in a way.
But I think so. Absolutely. Order from chaos.
Definitely. Now, continuing a little bit on this question of, you know, how, as you say, the version of Islam that you've been talking about compared to what is being shown today, or you know, which version it is, because it very, very much varies also depending on who you ask, because there are a lot of mixed messages out there, and we've talked about this from all kinds of angles as well. Yeah. I mean, some say it's a religion of peace, some say it's an extremely violent religion. I mean, I wanted to ask you, is it anti-West, anti-European, anti-Jewish at its core origin?
Well, you know, think of like, if you see, is the Occupy movement, is it anti-American? You know?
Yeah, probably.
I mean, well, not in the sense that they want to blow up buildings or, you know, not in the sense like, I mean, Islam, this is what I realize, you know, what they do is they make Muslims feel guilty for being critical of the U.S. as if somehow they're unpatriotic, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing wrong with being critical of the U.S. I mean, what society is going to survive without constant criticism and self-assessment? Right. So Islam offers certain kinds of reforms. But so this idiotic fear of Sharia, that Muslims are bringing Sharia. How can Muslims bring Sharia if Americans don't accept it? You know, it's not possible. The idea is that, you know, it's a fundamentally democratic movement, right? It works on, if people accept it, they accept it. If they don't, well, you keep working, you know. It's not, and fundamentally there are some disagreements between Islam and the West, but it doesn't mean that, it's just that this image of that, oh, because we disagree, we're going to, you know, destroy the World Trade Center or bomb innocent people, you know, that happens among a very tiny, tiny minority. But I think we have to accept that, you know, Muslims have just as much a legitimate right to offer recommendations for change. And the problem is I think Muslims need to stop feeling insecure about that. And instead, what they're trying to do is they're trying to show how much Islam is compatible with the existing moral structure and basis of the United States. Oh, we're not this and we're not that and we're this, you know, Islam is compatible with this, it's compatible with that, as opposed to saying, no, Islam is not compatible with that, but our answer is something different, which we think is better. Well, what's the threat about that, right?
Well, and it's kind of like, I mean, most Americans are against the imperialism that is exported, you know, under the democracy banner that the government and the military exudes over the rest of the world under the auspice of this occult, you know, force that you've been talking about.
Why shouldn't Muslims be opposed to corporatism, you know, control of the media? Undue influence of the Israel lobby in the United States, you know, on and on and on, you know, lobbying, campaign financing. Those, you know, those are just as much fundamental Islamic values. Are they being unpatriotic because they're pointing those things out?
No, I don't think so. And you have a bunch of valid criticism that comes out, I think, in a way, from a multitude of different, you know, societies. And I mean, personally, I'm one who has always been against any kind of control, any kind of status control or control of you know, the mind or anything like that. I'm more of an anarchist, actually, in that sense, aligned. I don't want to have a state governing or, you know, the educational system and everything else. And all these systems, you know, to me, then they come with a set of principles that is, you know, supplant on you. And that system that would allow a human being to live as free as they want to within that structure would be an ideal one, if we have to have one at all, you know, to me.
But, you know, we come together as communities and we have to make agreements. The thing is, you know, governments are not always corrupt and governments depend on the people. And, you know, they've managed to maintain tyranny right now by convincing people that government is always corrupt and not making people responsible to government, or worse still, convincing people that their responsibility to government is really completely futile attempts, like writing letters to your congressman and demonstrating and things like that, instead of actual true mobilization. You know, sometimes the existing systems of input don't work. So then you have to find other ones, you know. So I don't think it's government itself that's corrupt. And I think this is, you know, an attitude that we need to change. It's people themselves. Yeah, a society is a communal agreement, and because somehow we have to agree, we have to come together and decide on building roads and hospitals. And but if that system becomes corrupt, then it's responsible of the people to speak to the powers that be.
And I mean, people will always do that, no matter if there's a government to do that or not. If there's a need, people will, you know, organically come together and solve an issue. That's, you know, how even the concept of a government was formed in the beginning. The problem is when that is institutionalized and you have, professional politicians and everything else that are, you know, in a position of doing that. But I wanted to ask you about another thing, a separate thing here. I think it's called jizya, tax levied on non-Muslim citizens within an Islamic state. Is that part of the original or not?
Well, that's a levy against citizens outside of the state. And jizya is basically, it's an age-old practice called tribute. And every empire has done it for thousands of years.
Unfortunately, they have, yeah.
So if you conquer a state, it's yours. If you don't, well, you know, if you threaten them, then if you have the potential to conquer them, you say, okay, look, guy, I'm coming. I'm on the way, so if you don't want me to conquer you, then you know, I'll take tribute from you. And you know, and that's there's nothing new in Islam about that.
Now, there's so many other points here, of course, that we could go back to, and I wanted to dig some of them up here again. You mentioned Alexander Kojève. How did you pronounce his name again?
I'm not sure. I assume it's Kojève.
Kojève, that's right. He seems to have also been actually instrumental in creating the European Union. You know, he's a philosopher, Russian-born, but living in France most of his life. Tell us about his relationship with Hegel and a little bit of how he has been part of some of these processes.
Okay, well, how about we get into the subject of synarchism then?
Yes.
Because that's what it is.
Let's do it.
Okay, so synarchism is a Martinist tradition. So you've got two important factions around the time of the Illuminati. There's the Illuminati itself, then there's the Martinist order. And this was Martinist because it's named after Claude Paul de Saint-Martin, I think is what his name is, something like that. And it's, again, a Kabbalistic tradition, a theurgical tradition. And so there's several exponents who come out of that. One of them is Joseph, I'm going to pronounce it with my French accent, Joseph de Maistre, and after him, you have Saint-Yves d'Alvèdre. And Saint-Yves is the one who basically articulated this idea. He was a friend with, you know, he's involved in this entire circuit, and this is where everything becomes interrelated. He proposed that synarchism was the system used in Agartha. So now we're back to the idea of the hollow earth, which is again connected to Shambhala. And synarchism basically then came to mean rule by the elites of secret societies. So it's the idea that a society should be run by something approximating a Brahmin class. That you have like the bureaucrats. So politicians are nothing more than bureaucrats, but you have to have the priests, because the priests communicate with the gods. And now we're getting back to the whole idea of Martinist theurgy and, you know, contact with ascended masters and things like that. So communication with discarded entities. And, or, you know, things that were called channeling and mediumship, and seances and things like that. That's what the basis of that is. So this is what they call the entities that they contact, they call them gods. And they believe that, you know, they believe whatever stories they tell. So it's the idea that the priests do their rituals to make contact with the gods. The gods communicate their wishes to the priests. The priests communicate the wishes of the gods to the bureaucrats. So it's the influence of the belief that the ideal society is run by the elite of secret societies who behave as priests who are in contact with the gods.
And those gods, of course, are not anyone who's living on this, realm as well. So that's pretty interesting. You have taking advice from someone who's not even part of it. That's
ultra-terrestrials, I think.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're called. So, so the most important exponent of this, who regarded Alvèdre as, you know, his mentor, was Pappus, otherwise named as Gerard Ancos, one of the most important occultists of the period. He was a member of pretty much every order, not only head grandmaster of the Martinists, but also the Theosophical Society, the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light, I think the Golden Dawn, like you name a society at the time and he was in it. And there's also claims that he was responsible for the protocols.
The protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Yep. What I traced this in depth in my book, and the protocols were a product of the Rite of Memphis Mizra. So
an Egyptian kind of branch, if you will, of Freemasonry, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is what I was talking about. It's a branch of the Rosicrucian legend. So out of the Asiatic Brethren, numerous groups came out, and basically Egyptian Freemasonry came out of the Asiatic Brethren because it was built out of the Rosicrucian legend. So out of that, that's how you get the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor, an Egyptian Rite Freemasonry, which kind of continually work hand in hand. So you find that all the people who are involved in the emergence or revelation or any kind of relationship with the emergence of the protocols were all affiliated with the Rite of Memphis and Mizraim. And the Grand Master of it was Garibaldi.
Ah.
Who was head of the Carabinieri.
Right.
Which gets back to Mazzini. That's how all these things are interconnected. So Pappus now heads a conspiracy in St. Petersburg in Russia that involves all the leading characters of the time. It even looks like Aleister Crowley was there. And for this plot to rally the people of Tibet against the Soviet Union using the myth of Shambhala. And in there is George Gurdjieff, who's central to this entire plot. And he's supposedly one and the same with the emissary of the Dalai Lama, whose name is Lama Dorjiev, which is obviously similar to Gurdjieff. And most of Gurdjieff's followers thought he was the same person. This is another tangent. I'm not sure if we could go down that way, because that's how we get to the Nazis and their relationship with Buddhism and onto the Dalai Lama and things like that. But I'm just trying to introduce the wider connections of Pappus.
Yep.
But that was a Martinist plot in St. Petersburg. So to come back to the other tangent. So Martinist, Pappus's main follower was René Guénon.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And René Guénon is the one who founded what's called traditionalism. Traditionalism is not really anything new. It's the same ideology that was resurrected by Blavatsky from the Renaissance, which is the idea of the theologia, which is the idea that all the esoteric religions contain a single esoteric truth. And this is basically what Guénon taught. Except that what Guénon taught basically taught that, so if all the all the conventional religions all share a single truth, then you can pick anyone. So that's why he picked Islam. And he converted to Islam, and then he was accepted into the Shadhili Sufi order. The Shadhili Sufi order was a tradition that was started, several centuries behind, but the one that he followed was rooted back with the person I mentioned earlier, which is Abdul Qadir al-Jazairi.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he was the central person in this hotbed of British intelligence activity in Damascus and Syria that involved, again, Blavatsky, Richard Burton, Gene Digby, Scanlon Blunt, and the whole crew. So now René Guénon and this traditionalism becomes the basis of the Sufi tradition that evolves into the Sufi influence into the New Age movement. Again, bringing back the influence of George Gurdjieff and Idris Shah and so on and so forth. So I'm realizing now there's two chances. We got to get back to Alexander Koyev. So René Guénon's leading student is Julius Evola. And Julius Evola, he didn't convert to Islam, but he kept he kept the Guinot's idea of traditionalism, and he's also pretty much the godfather of Italian neo-fascism. And he was the ideologue for all the fascist groups that were employed by CIA and NATO in a strategy of tension in the 70s, or what's known as Operation Gladio. So now we can get back to the earlier tangent. So out of the Synarchist tradition, there was a number of basically the Synarchists decided to infiltrate politics, and really their earliest focus seems to have been in France. And they infiltrated various organizations, but one of the most important organizations that they created was what's called the Pan-European Union, the PEU,
right,
which was headed by Count
Coudenhove Kalergi.
Thank you, yes. Kalergi. So the first person to join his Pan-European Union is the basis that provided the groundwork for the evolution of the existing European Union.
Definitely. Yep.
The first to join the PEU was Hallmar Schacht, the head of the Reichsbank. It also turns out it was Hallmar Schacht and Otto Skorzeny, who just prior to the end of the war were commanded with the responsibility of protecting, rescuing the assets, the looted assets of the Nazis, which they had stolen from, you know, all the Jewish property they had stolen, whatever else they had stolen from parts of the world. And this is how Skorzeny ends up in Argentina and stuff like this. And there's a fascinating story I have in my book about his relationship with Evita Peron.
Hmm.
So this shows the connection now with the Nazis. Of course, the Nazis were all funded by Rockefeller funding through IG Farben and all these, all these connections, Skull and Bones connections, which implicates the Bush family. And this is the relationship between the PEU, the Nazis, and then British intelligence, because behind all this, one of the main agents of this support with the Nazis was the Dulles brothers. And now, of course, Alan Dulles becomes head of the CIA after World War I. So the European Union was a project of the CIA. And this is where Alexander Koyev comes in. And Koyev he's considered the leading scholar of Hegelianism in the 20th century. And his main students are Carl Schmitt. Carl Schmitt was the leading jurist of the Third Reich, but somehow managed to escape unscathed after the war. He then becomes buddies with Leo Strauss. So, right? So how does the godfather of the neoconservatives become buddies with the jurists of the Third Reich? And they're all followers of Heidegger, who they regard as the ultimate guru of the 20th century, despite the fact that Heidegger never really repudiated or denied his support for the Nazis either. And so Koyev basically modernizes the Hegelian interpretation, and he creates this notion of the end of history. And so his influence is pivotal, because it influences both Leo Strauss, who is the godfather of the conservatives, who are the architects of everything that we're seeing today, of the clean break strategy, the Arab Spring, and so on and so forth, and of Francis Fukuyama, who wrote The End of History, which provided the basis for the... basically, Huntington elaborated on Fukuyama's End of History to create the whole idea of a clash of civilizations, which means a clash between the secular West and theocratic Islam, which is the build-up to what I think is World War III.
Let me ask you a little bit about Marx as well in all this. Koyev was not, you read on his Wiki page or whatever, he says, you know, he's not a Marxist or whatever, but he was kind of flirting with a lot of those ideas, you know, and brought that into it as well.
Yeah, he was a Marxist.
He was a Marxist.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. That's easy enough.
I guess you could call him a neo-Marxist or something like that.
Yeah, well, exactly. That, I was kind of getting to that because later when Leo Strauss comes out with the neoconservative kind of ideology as well, there are some interesting articles out there that have connected this more to kind of a Trotskyite ideology than anything else. It's not conservative. It's a completely, neocon, right? It's the new con. That's what they're coming with.
It's not conservatism. It's neoliberalism.
That's right.
It's not the same thing.
So this is a very, very kind of, I mean, although I see very much that there is a very religious tone, shall we say, to Marxism, to socialism, to a lot of this stuff that's coming out in the early, you know, the 1900s and all these new ideologies and everything else. It's very much religious in origin, it is Hegelian, but externally they say that this is all, you know, liberated from these, you know, clutches of idea of God, and it's a more atheistic and scientific in nature and everything else. But what would you say to that?
Well, Kabbalah is atheistic. You know, the Sabbateans, right? Sorry, however you pronounce it. Their project is to eradicate all religions, including Judaism. You know, they believe they reject the Bible and accept only the Torah. So they've actually had a history of being pretty anti-Semitic. You know, they fought and undermined other aspects of the Jewish community, specifically because they stubbornly stick to the Bible. And that's very much the root of the conflict now between Orthodox Jews and the State of Israel, because Zionism is a Sabbatean ideology, which is an anti-religious ideology, despite the fact that they, you know, keep the veneer of religion. It's not religious at all.
Yeah. So it's an internal battle and strife that goes on with this. Should they remain, you know, rabbinical in origin, or should they scrap it altogether?
Well, you know, I believe that Judaism is a legitimate religious tradition, like most of the other traditions, and I see Zionism as being a plot to undermine it, to not only undermine it, but so many other religions, and it's a political plot.
Yeah,
and it's a dangerous one.
It sure is. Oh yeah. If we zoom out a little bit here, there's been some great stuff here that you've shared with us, and some interesting points and opinions about this. What is the goal of this? And if we only can refer to them as, you know, the secret society or whatever, because as you detailed now, they go through many different orders, they go through many different names, and yet the ideology seems to kind of remain the same, and they try to undermine culture, destroy religion, destroy nationality, etc. There's a number of things going on here. What is it driven by? If you could, put up a couple of bullet points here of what the goal is of what they're trying to do here.
Fulfillment of Bible prophecy, and in their own perverted interpretation. So, as far as they see, you know, it starts with the Kabbalah of Isaac Luria, and which teaches that, throughout history, it's always been about the coming of the Messiah. So like Isaac Luria teaches that you don't sit around and wait for him to come. You have to actively prepare his coming, which means everything they're doing. You know, it's not the legitimate political methods that you and I would prefer. It, for them, the ends justify the means. And for them, anything underhanded, anything that works, you know, their elitism is basically what leads them to use the more underhanded means, because they fundamentally don't respect the average person. As far as they're concerned, they are God's chosen, and they have the right to dispose of people however they will. So basically what they think, as I said earlier, is that the history of the world is that of man progressing to come to realize that he is God. So it's a progression towards the secularism. And this is where the idea of that's what Hegel articulated in the language. It's Kabbalah, but he articulated it in the language of German philosophy. And that was continued by Nietzsche and his idea of the Superman. The Superman is the man who is able to face what he thinks is the truth, that God is dead, and to overcome the nihilism that would normally result from it and invent his own morality. And that's why Nietzsche becomes essentially the godfather of 20th century fascism. both the Nazis and pretty much any other fascist group that emerged as well. And so what they are doing is preparing the world. So the Messiah, in their mind, will be the person who has fulfilled history, who has achieved the end of history by recognizing that he is God. So they're preparing the world for his advent. And, you know, that's why all these worlds are necessary for that. And World War III will be necessary to create the stage for a new world order, which will be the seat of his power. And the New Age is all about preparing that, because the New Age is going to be his religion. So this was all supposed to happen at the age of Aquarius, and he's supposed to be called Maitreya. And it might be as far-fetched as, you know, he's supposed to come down in a flying saucer and things like that.
Now, do you believe in any of this?
Well, see, this is what's really fascinating, which I found in my book. And I've often wondered about what the heck was going on with UFOs. And I have now answered that question to my satisfaction, and I believe it's an entirely a hoax. If you look at, basically, the entire UFO mythos is theosophy. What you have is, in the occult revival begins with spiritism. And spiritism means it attempts to contact spirits. So things like seances, channeling, mediumship, and things like this. So how it occurred is that Blavatsky argued that society had become overly scientific and had become so empirical that they would deny the existence of what she called the supernatural. And because in her mind, there was matter and there was spirit. So it wasn't matter and there was God. There was like this intermediary realm, which is kind of like a divine matter or something like that. So what happened is that these spirits that were contacted, there was many suggestions that the what they represented. And they themselves would claim to be all kinds of things. You know, they would tell you whatever they want. They'd tell you they're your grandma, that they're the Genghis Khan of Julius Caesar, that they're, you know, a god from an inhabitant from another planet. I mean, they're pretty creative when it comes to the lies that they're willing to share. And so, you know, out of this is where it came out, Blavatsky's idea of ascended masters. And of course, these ascended masters live in Shambhala, where they've been ruling the world. They're actually Lucifer and the fallen angels and so on and so forth. But basically, this idea, what they've done is they've retained the idea, which is actually 2,500 years old, which is the idea, which is always being part of ancient mysteries, of the Babylonians used to worship the planets as gods.
Right.
That's what it is. It's, you know, when in Gnosticism and Kabbalah and Merkaba mysticism, when you would ascend through the planets, which is the way they saw it, you had to pronounce the sacred names to the spirits that guarded the planets. So there's constantly this association of spirits with certain planets. And this is what the Renaissance was all about. You know, the Greeks inherited from the Babylonians, so they also worshiped the planets as gods as well. This is something that Plato recommended. So the Renaissance was the same thing. That's why it's the birth of Venus. You know, most of the art were astrological depictions, because they were astrological talismans designed to bring down the powers or the spirits of the planets. Or it was a hermetic practice of capturing the planetary spirits in the paintings. So then now we have this idea of spirits from other planets. So out of this early occult revival movement, of these numerous interpretations of where these spirits came from, then you develop, and the Theosophists developed this idea of the Lords of the Flame. So these people, these spirits living in Shambhala ruling the world, were actually the Lords of the Flame, and they came from Venus and things like this. And this is how you get this idea of visitors from other planets. So when you look at all the people who were the first so-called contactees, they were all involved with Theosophy. And a particularly interesting crew, I won't be able to repeat all the details. I'll have people look at my book to look them up. But there's what's called the four guys named George. There's George Adamski, George Hunt Williamson, George King, and there's another George, I can't remember what his name is, all affiliated with occult orders, almost all affiliated with Blavatsky, with Theosophy, also mostly affiliated with fascism, particularly William Dudley Paley's Silver Shirts. George Hunt Williamson, who was buddies with Adamski, he was not only affiliated with Paley, but he was also buddies with Andrea Paharich. You know him?
Sure. We've talked about him many times. Yeah.
So that's where you get the birth of this whole concept of the Council of the Nine, which is all initiated by the CIA and really develops in tandem with this whole idea of contact with extraterrestrial life. But, you know, like Jacques Vallée has pointed out, there's never a ship. But Jacques Vallée set out to prove that UFOs existed. He finally concluded that something is happening, but this is not the perception that people are used to. He says his conclusion is that there's some kind of contact with entities, the same kind of entities that people have claimed contact with for thousands of years. Because if you look at most of the supposed contact, it's either recalled through hypnosis, it happens through out-of-body experience, and almost all kind of contact is channeled, or what they say is telepathic contact.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not UFOs. That's theosophy. That's just the same spiritism that has been practiced for thousands of years.
But you would say, David, that the spirits are real. These people are not delusional or anything like that. They're actually getting in contact with something.
Well, you know, in Islam, we have this belief in jinn.
Right.
And you know, in Islam, the devil is not a fallen angel. He's a jinn. And they are beings who have, you know, they're not supernatural. They're just operate in a type of physics that we have yet to explain. They're beings who are composed of a matter or some substance which is different than ours. I think maybe they are composed of energy is my theory. I don't know what they're composed of, but they exist, and that's, you know, some of them are good, some of them are bad, and you know, but you know, that's what happens, is that they're, you know, they're no more divine than any other human being, but they've managed to convince the synarchists that they are divine beings from Shambhala and whatever it is that they're telling them.
Well, it was interesting. I think George Damski also founded something that's called the Royal Order of Tibet, and it goes just kind of hand in hand with what you've been talking about here.
Exactly. You know, a key character in this whole scenario is H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, he has some interesting books out there for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Like, most of his concepts were derived from theosophy, and he pretty much laid the groundwork for much of this UFO mythos.
Well, interesting. There is certainly a whole lot more to the story, and we'll have to pick it up at another time, David, as we begin to wrap things up for this time. But it was very, very interesting. Good to have you back again, and you know, talking about your latest work, and for more, of course, we'll have to relay people to the websites, and then after that, pick up a copy of the book, of course, if you want to read more on David's work and research. Black Terror, White Soldiers, Islam, Fascism, and the New Age is the whole book title. Give us your website again then, David, so people know where to go.
Thank you. It's at www.terrorism-illuminati.com. A Google search brings it up very quickly as well.
Very good. Thank you for your time today, David. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. We appreciate your interest, and we hope you have new things to contemplate and look further into. Later on Red Ice Radio, Charles Eisenstein, Neil Sanders, Anthony Peake, Neil Kramer, and Chaird Andringa, to name a few. My thanks to Lana, Frederick, Elizabeth, and John, and we'll talk to you in just a few days. I hope you have a good day. Take it easy, and thank you for listening.